to say anything is unfair or wrong or evil requires that there is a supreme standard of fair and right and good.
Welcome to the Mama Bear Apologetics Podcast. I'm Hillary.
And I'm Amy.
We are just two gals who are spiritually armed, highly caffeinated,
and just sassy enough to make bad ideas cry. Mama Bear is a ministry dedicated to helping you raise children who think critically, love biblically, and stand firm in the faith using scripture, reason, and reality.
Because remember, Mama Bears, this might not affect your faith,
but it might affect your children's. Hey, everyone. Welcome to another Mama Bear Apologetics Podcast, a podcast dedicated to helping you raise children who think critically, love biblically, and stand firm in the faith using scripture, reason, and reality. Well, we have just had an amazing time with our resident Nana Bear, Tricia Scribner. And what we have been doing, especially over these last two episodes, is looking at the top reasons that Christianity is true and providing evidence through arguments on the existence of atheistic God. Now, over our past two episodes, we've looked at two particular arguments. The first one was the Kalam cosmological argument, otherwise known as the cause and effect argument. And then we took a look at the teleological argument, which can otherwise be known as the order and design argument. Now, the third one we want to look at today is another powerful argument for the existence of a theistic God through morality, otherwise known as the moral argument. So a fun way to refer to it is, you know, we have the cause and effect. Now we've got with morality, it's the right and wrong argument. And what we're going to learn today is that if there is anything that is objectively right and wrong, then it had to have come from a source and that had to be a moral being, specifically, which we'll get to God. Now, what's wonderful about these arguments is these are very easy to remember. They're short, they're quick, they follow one another, the premises and the conclusions. So these are wonderful arguments that we can be using as we disciple our own children. And so for this moral argument, Tricia, you know, this one's one of those beautifully easy ones to remember. So how would the moral or the right and wrong argument go?
Okay, three steps. First two are premises. If there is a moral law, there is a lawgiver. Second, there is a moral law. Third is the conclusion. Therefore, there is a moral lawgiver. Now, an argument we are looking for to be sound. We want it to make sense. We want each of the premises to be true and the conclusion to follow logically from those premises, which means that it's valid. This is what we want for our argument. And this is a valid and sound argument. So let's take a look at that very first premise. I'll read it, Amy, and then you explain what is the first condition that we're saying. If there is a moral law, there is a moral lawgiver.
Yeah, this is just a beautiful cause and effect. Yes, this has to exist because any moral law that's out there, it had to have come from an intelligent mind. Now, the important thing we have to do first, though, is when we are looking at that very first premises, we have to understand what we mean by moral law. And it helps to distinguish between descriptive statements and moral statements. These are two different things. So the first one we kind of want to look at are descriptive statements. Now, these type of statements make observational claims about the world around us. So this would be like saying, well, it's sunny outside right now, or my favorite dress is red. Description statements describe what is the case in the world around us, but they cannot make moral arguments, meaning that they don't say something is right, good, wrong, bad, that sort of thing. So descriptive statements are very different from moral statements.
Yes, they are. And the way that we know that moral law or moral statements require a lawgiver is that moral statements are different. They are statements about what is right or wrong. That makes them different than just what is the case or what is the current state of affairs, like the descriptions you just have. It's a difference between descriptive and prescriptive. It's a difference between what is and what ought to be or should be. So when I say you ought not say that, that's mean. I am saying a moral statement. Our viewers can likely think of an experience in which they declared something was bad or unfair. You remember maybe just saying that's just wrong. Okay, whenever we assess saying an action or say an action or a statement, and we assess it as right or wrong, we're saying the person is not acting consistently with what they ought to do, what is right. So the first premise to our argument is that if there is such a thing as this moral law, it can only come from a moral being, because natural laws that we've just described, like gravity and descriptive, are descriptive statements, just like the descriptive statements you just made about a dress being red or a certain color, those kinds of things. Natural laws like gravity only describe what is. When I'm holding the pencil and I drop it, it falls. That's a description of what is, just like the statements that were descriptive statements that you used. But moral law is different, as we can see, because it states something that ought to be a certain way. And it requires a person to make that judgment and set the standard originally. It can't just come out of nature or out of an impersonal force.
Yeah, that's such a good point, which brings us to our next premise. So premise two says that it makes the bold claim that there is a moral law, meaning that there is an objective moral standard that is written on the hearts of all human beings, that is intuitive to each person, and is often reflected within society. So this is where we usually see the first challenge against the moral argument for the existence of God come into play. Now, some people will try to discount the existence of objective moral law by saying that moral laws are subjective to each person or society. They might say that, you know, moral laws are just a person's opinions and they're not universally applicable. Oftentimes they will point out different societies and say, see, they have a different understanding. Therefore, an objective moral standard can't possibly exist. So these sorts of things, you know, they might say that moral laws are really just sort of like strong feelings that we have about the actions of certain people. So this is quite a bold challenge. So Tricia, you know, how have maybe you seen this in some of your research being suggested?
Yeah, what you're describing is a common belief. Let me give you just one example, just from a cursory research that I did on the relationship between understanding moral law as objective and understanding it as subjective and connected only with emotions. There's a professor of psychology who in 2019 wrote about morality. His name is John A. Johnson, and he said that the awareness of rightness and wrongness about human thoughts and actions comes from subjective feelings, not from objective truth. This is a very common belief, but now we have a professor of psychology who has expressed this belief as an academic. He insists that any moral ought kind of statements are really just grounded in emotions or feelings, whereas is statements, the ones we describe like the dress is red or natural law, gravity, when I drop the pencil, it falls, those are the only ones that are actually connected to an objective state of affairs. And this is what he says as a quote. He says, ordinary judgments about moral right and wrong in everyday life are based on emotions, not dispassionate analysis of what is objectively true. If we are asked to explain why we feel that something is right or wrong, we can sometimes conjure up such an explanation after the fact, but the feeling comes first, signaling us about whether something is right or wrong. Now, when we look at the statement, we agree with him on part of it and concede that it's true that we often do feel strong emotion when we see a wrong, a cruelty, or something we would label as an evil act or a wrong. In fact, we may not first think that it is wrong or that is just a wrong, but rather immediately respond with anger or fear or even outrage. Like when the news describes a child or an innocent person being harmed. Let me just give you an example. I was just watching TV yesterday, watching a news episode where recently a man walked by an elderly man on the sidewalk, standing in his driveway, and shoved him down. You can actually see the man almost bounce off the concrete. It killed him. And my hand went up to my mouth. I was horrified. So I didn't process that and think that is violating the moral law. That is wrong. I immediately felt rage. I felt outraged that this could be allowed to happen and that the person who did this had very little consequence for his action of taking the life of this man who was innocently standing there and had nothing to do or no interaction with the man who had wronged him. So we don't have to stop and judge, is that right or wrong, many times. We already know many things are wrong. Romans 2:15 explains to us, in fact, why. It says that the Gentiles innately know there is rightness and wrongness, even though they don't have the law that is available to the Jews. We know rightness and wrongness about human thoughts and actions. And it says they show that the work of the law is written on their hearts, while their conscience also bears witness and their conflicting thoughts accuse or even excuse them. We innately recognize specific wrong and evil actions because the moral law is inside of us, as you were saying, written on our heart as humans, as part of the imago Dei, we as Christians would argue. And this awareness even extends to our judgment of our own actions and words. We feel condemned. We feel guilty. Are our emotions ever out of line, or do they ever dominate our intellect in terms of judgment of right and wrong? Absolutely. But this doesn't mean that responding to a heinous act emotionally is merely or only an emotional reaction, that it's not informed by the intellect. It very much is informed by the intellect.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what's kind of frustrating about Dr. Johnson's conclusion, because he's basically saying that our very just reaction, emotional reaction to that, is basically just saying, oh, well, I don't like this, rather than making an objective truth claim, no, this is wrong, to where this violates my preference of human behavior. Okay. You know,
that's a very good way to state it, Amy. I like that very much. It makes it like, oh, that makes me feel emotional and angry. I don't like that feeling. It's all about me when it's confined to the emotions. And you're making an extremely good point. That is so much our culture, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, and it is, because it's like this scapegoat way of trying to reject an objective moral standard by saying, oh, that's just, you're just being emotional about this right now, which would kind of imply like, okay, if you wanted to maybe become a more in control of yourself individual, you would have to sort of silence those emotional reactions. You know, my son's been watching Star Wars here recently, and that's the goal of the Jedi, is to not sort of be emotionally swayed. You have to trust your feelings, but not allow your feelings to overtake you in a way that you're not supposed to feel love or hate or any of these other things. And that's what it seems like it's trying to do, is to say, okay, no, objective moral standard doesn't exist. That's just you saying you didn't like that thing. But then what that ultimately does is that now removes our ability for even punishing wrongdoing, because all it is it reduces people to, well, there's one group that doesn't like this, and there's another group who says that this is okay. So then there's no way to relegate the two together. So, I mean, this is wild to me. And the problem is, you know, we want to make sure that our children are properly attuned to feelings. And especially with little kids, you know, sometimes they will have an emotional reaction first before they can properly understand the reason why they're having that emotional reaction. So we don't want to shut that off in our kids, because it's where we get that phrase, you know, trust your gut type of thing, which, you know, depending on the circumstance, can be true or false. But we want to make sure that our kids recognize, okay, if you have an emotional reaction, that should be your tipping point, your signal. I think T.C. Cannon refers to it as a check engine light. That needs to be your check engine light to then investigate the cause of that emotional reaction. Because, you know, one thing that I've said for years, and it jokingly came up between me and my father-in-law, he's a very emotional individual. And, you'd give these appeals. And one thing he loved to say to me is, Amy, feelings are real. I go, yes, you're absolutely right, but they're not always true. And so for our kids, we want to rightly affirm that, you know, a feeling can be a very real reaction to an objectively true moral claim, or a violation of an objectively true moral claim. But just because you have an emotional response doesn't mean that truth does not exist, or that it's only an emotional reaction. So again, with kids, we really want to make sure they understand that distinction, because unfortunately, a lot of our culture is trying to base truth and root it in feelings, meaning that if you feel something, then it must be true, good, and moral, and you must pursue after that. And we say, no, 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 that's a false understanding. Instead, we need to recognize that feelings are real. They're not always true. So feelings need to be tested for truth, which will inevitably nurture healthy emotional control. Now, when it comes to examples to use in these arguments, some of the easiest ways to prove the existence of an objectively true moral claim unfortunately results in using some examples that are rather graphic, which some of the ones that we'll reference here later on in this conversation, you'll want to see which would be appropriate for your kids. So often a very common example that's used is, you know, like hurting an animal for fun is always wrong. Now, if you've got younger children and or maybe like a new puppy in the house, that might be an example that they would not, you know, they might have a very big reaction to. You can always use it a little differently, like stealing things for fun is always wrong, which most kids intuitively know, because if they've had a classmate or a sibling swipe some of their candy or their cookie or something of that, they automatically, they will have that emotional reaction. They will register, yes, you're right, that is absolutely wrong. So when you're using examples to prove that objective moral values do in fact exist, they tend to be a little more on the graphic side, like hurting an animal or hurting a child for fun is wrong. So adjust the examples that you use per your kids to help them understand the existence of these moral values.
Hey, this is Hillary from Mama Bear Apologetics, and I want to tell you a little bit about the Air Doctor. So, two stories about this. Number one, my parents came to visit after we had a bunch of construction downstairs, and I noticed that my dad kept coughing and sneezing down in the basement. So, what we did was we put our Air Doctor down there, and I tell you, like, one night and he was not coughing anymore. Second story about the Air Doctor. Everybody marvels at the fact that we have a cat and we have a cat box and nobody can smell it. So there are a lot of benefits to the Air Doctor. You're going to have fewer odors. You're going to have reduced allergy symptoms, better sleep, extra protection during wildfire season. I know we got some of our California mama bears. This is a big one. And just peace of mind and cleaner air for your kids. I mean, what's more important than having clean air? So Air Doctor has a powerful 3-stage filtration, which captures extremely small particles, about 100 times smaller than what typical air purifiers can remove. And not only that, but it captures airborne contaminants that you don't want breathing in, like dust and pollen, mold spores, pet dander, bacteria, viruses, odors, smoke, ozone, all the things. And it's really, really quiet. Even though we hear it turn on, it's still very quiet. It's like you just barely hear the fan that's coming on. It's got an auto feature mode, which means that you don't have to be fiddling with it all the time. It ensures optimal air 24/7. And it also even gives you change filter reminders, so you don't have to put some kind of alarm in your phone for every however long that you need to change the air filter. Air Doctor has won Newsweek's Reader's Choice Award for Best Air Purifier, and it was voted Best Air Purifier in the Green Matters Approved Awards. So if you're wanting cleaner air, or you just have a cat and you don't want it to smell like you have a cat, head on over to airdoctorpro.com and use promo code MBA to get up to $300 off today. Air Doctor comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee plus a 3-year warranty. That's an $84 value. So get this exclusive podcast-only offer now at airdoctorpro.com. That's AIRDOCTORPRO.com. And use the promo code MBA, as in Mama Bear Apologetics.
Confession time, mamas. When I am in my house chasing after my toddler, I am usually wearing a pair of joggers. I love them. I mean, they're comfortable and they're adaptable for everyday life, which is why I wanted to introduce you to our sponsor, Cozy Earth. Cozy Earth makes brushed bamboo joggers that are made from viscose from bamboo. They have a tapered fit with a relaxed waistband and just enough structure to feel intentional, which if you are a busy mom, that is exactly what you're looking for. It's perfect for morning coffee, afternoon errands, or evenings winding down. These joggers, they're gonna go with your day wherever it takes you. Now, what's amazing about this is that they come with a 10-year warranty. So this spring, give yourself the kind of comfort that lives with you all day, not just the moments you get home. head over to CozyEarth.com and use our code MAMABEAR, that's M-A-M-A-BEAR, for an exclusive 20% off. And if you see the post-purchase survey, mention that you happen to hear about Cozy Earth right here on Mama Bear Apologetics. That's Cozy Earth. Comfort lives here.
I wanted to make a point there about what you're saying.
Yeah.
I think that's that not just aiming at their emotions to respond.
Right.
It's very helpful that you've brought up with our kids. And that is, yes, we could say hurting a puppy is always wrong. But if that's going to elicit only an emotional reaction, we're wanting also to engage their intellect.
Yes.
Also, so that they have that to measure the emotions against, to evaluate and assess their emotions and what to do with them in light of the truth. So being able to step back, something that is not as emotionally laden, like describing the scene I just described to you that I saw on the news, that was disturbing to me as an adult, and certainly would be disturbing to a child. So I emotionally responded, but we also want to engage their intellect and put their emotions in the context of being under the domain of what they know to be true and under the intellect. And that's how the Holy Spirit works and helps us to bring those under control and submission to truth.
Yeah.
Anyway, I thought it was a great point.
Yeah, no, thank you for clarifying on that. And what's really neat though about this argument is all you have to do is point out that just one objective moral value exists, and then that affirms that second premise. So really important. But you know what's interesting though is, you know, we've explained that the moral law is not merely just a subjective emotional response. It's not you just being upset by something you watched on TV or heard on the radio, as, you know, Johnson argued. There are some other arguments that skeptics try to raise against the idea that objective moral laws exist. So Trisha, can you explain maybe a few or one or two of those examples that skeptics try to use?
In regard to the second premise, which argues that there is a moral law, an objective moral standard out there, skeptics will often argue things like a universal moral law doesn't exist because what is right or wrong differs across societies. And so it might be relative to people, time, or place. For example, I was watching an interview not too long ago of a Muslim, I believe he was an imam, and he was sitting with another gentleman from the Western culture, and that gentleman had propped his leg up on his knee and had the sole of his shoe showing. And the imam commented how disrespectful that was. So is this an example that the moral law is actually not objective, but subjective, because it differs? And the guy from Western culture thought nothing of it, but the guy from the Eastern culture saw it as wrong and evil and offensive to human dignity. Does that show then that it's subjective? And many would argue that it does, because there's a difference, a distinct difference there in what we label as moral, immoral, right or wrong. But here's the thing. While the custom or the expression of a value may be relative to culture, the underlying value itself is universal. So let's stop and think for a minute. The sole of the shoe is a sign of disrespect when put toward another human being. So when we want to figure out what the value is, we have to ask why.
Yeah.
That tells us what the underlying value that's universal is. Even though the sole of shoe showing that is disrespectful to human dignity in one culture and not in another, the underlying value that both appreciate is the innate dignity of humans. We may show it in different ways across different cultures, but that doesn't make the value subjective, only the expression of it subjective. Okay?
Oh, I love that distinction. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, C.S. Lewis also makes note that it's very interesting that even though you say that values differ across cultures and therefore moral law is subjective, not objective, that's not really true. He brings up the example of a soldier in battle abandoning his comrades. No culture values abandonment. Rather, we affirm the courage of supporting your comrades, even in the face of death. No culture, you said, would laud that behavior. No culture affirms that murdering for fun, raping for fun, is the right thing to do. Think even of cultures who are cannibalistic, maybe Hamas in all the rapes that they performed during the attack not that long ago. We always rationalize why we did. We had a justification, a reason, or an excuse for doing it. Maybe it's what we perceived as mistreatment toward our people. Therefore, that behavior that we did that would usually be wrong is justified. Mm-hmm. So the very fact that we make excuses for it show us that moral law is actually objective. So because it applies to our own actions as well. So virtually all societies affirm that murder and rape are evil. And this doesn't just stop us from performing evil as human, but because when we do commit an evil, we rationalize it or justify it, we recognize it as normally and universally evil and make an excuse for it. All humans fail to keep it consistently.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And then it would be completely justifiable if it truly was based in our subjective understanding, because this is just what I believe to be true. And I love that, because that ties into, you know, what Frank Turek and Norman Geisler, they distinguish between absolute value versus the relative standing. So the absolute value or the meaning, it's true for everyone across cultures. It's an absolute value that human dignity is to be respected, but how that respect is shown is different across cultures. And so again, and typically when those absolute values are violated, what ends up happening is they twist the definition, especially with regards to humans, of what it means to be human. So you mentioned the Hamas attacks on October 7th. I mean, the reason why rape is so common is because anyone who is not a Muslim is seen as less than a pig, and it's actually justifiable to have those acts occur because it's meant to humiliate them and basically force them into sort of repentance and assimilation. So it's you know, which we would objectively say is wrong, but yet this is how they're trying to justify it within that sort of relative understanding. And, you know, when you can look at the core absolute that each share, then you can kind of understand why different cultures believe different things. So Frank Turek and Norman Geisler give kind of a hilarious example with regards to Hindus. Hindus do not eat cows. They see them as sacred. And part of the reason why that is because of their beliefs within reincarnation. So the reason why they're not eating cattle is because within their beliefs on reincarnation, they believe that their family members could potentially come back as cattle. And as Frank quips, you know, all cultures agree that it's wrong to eat grandma. And so that's where, you know, we can help our kids especially distinguish between the difference of relative understandings and then understand, okay, how is this rooted in their worldview? And from there, then we start unpacking, okay, but is this worldview true? Is reincarnation true? What are the problems? Where is truth ultimately found? To where you can actually piece through and work through these conversations with your kids. But yeah, spotting those shared absolute values is really important. So, you know, that kind of brings us back to this idea of morality. You know, if morality was actually subjective, then no one nation could speak up against the actions of another nation. So Francis Schaeffer had this wonderful quote. He goes, "There must be an absolute if there are to be morals, and there must be an absolute if there are to be real values." So again, these have to exist for us to be able to have morals and have values. Now, there's another challenge against the existence of objective moral values, and it comes from Darwinism. It comes from an evolutionary perspective.
Yes. So this one is raised by atheists that say what appears to be the moral law is simply a survival mechanism or a socially learned behavior. And it's for the sake of survival, which fits neatly within Darwinism and neo-Darwinism, because survival fittest is the mechanism by which things survive as a species. So atheist philosopher Michael Ruse says it like this. He says, morality is just an aid to survival and reproduction. So you act nice and get along. Of course, Frank Turek always brings up, well, what about Hitler? He didn't get along with anyone but his own henchmen and everybody else he just used. And they were just pawns in his hand. So, but Ruse argues morality is an ephemeral product of the evolutionary process, just as other adaptations. It has no existence or being beyond this, and any deeper meaning is illusory, end quote. Now, in his way of thinking, then, what appears to be a universal moral law actually aids in the survival of the tribe or the community. And so propagation of the species is what is aimed at, which is what we would expect with natural selection. You know, that's what we would expect in this evolutionary paradigm in which you want to get along in order to help your tribe survive to reproduce.
Yeah, that is really interesting, because if that were true, then yeah, we should ultimately be really supportive of what Hitler did, because he justified eugenics based on Darwin's theory of evolution, that you're actually helping the society as a whole by wiping out the weaker, the socially and morally and physically infirm. Like this should have been something we all support. But yet all nations rose up and said, no, what you're doing is absolutely objectively wrong. Now, in some sense, you know, this sort of challenge, it sounds a little bit more plausible than perhaps the complete rejection of moral values, but it does have some fatal flaws, because, you know, if morality is just an evolutionary process, then, you know, our species is currently, with our current worldview, is sort of spiraling down this moral drain. Because when we take a look at social justice movements in particular, which are all the rage right now, they actually are systematically destroying our species more than what it's helping. You know, they're murdering the unborn. They're sterilizing those who are confused about their identity. They're vilifying men who, last I checked, are pretty integral to the propagation of the species. And I mean, they're attacking the family structure, which, you know, the family has the highest rate of childhood health and societal stability. Like, that's being wiped out. You know, from an evolutionary standpoint, they should actually be rallying against secular morality, because it's leading to the destruction of society, not actually it's flourishing, which, you know, is kind of wild to me. So, you know, how does Lewis respond to a claim that like one that Michael Ruse makes? Like, you know, he said morality is just an aid to survival and reproduction. What would Lewis sort of have to say about that?
Yeah, C.S. Lewis, let's put this in context. It would be like saying it's instinctual or instinctive to look out for those in your tribe or family. It has nothing to do with genuine love or the respect for human dignity and the imago Dei within every human being, no matter what stage of life, beginning or end. But C.S. Lewis says, yeah, we do have instincts. We have natural urges. But some atheists would argue, okay, well then the moral law is just that instinct. That's what they're saying. We may have two competing instincts, Lewis said. That's the problem. It's not just a single instinct. Think about when somebody's drowning or in trouble. We have this initial instinct to protect ourselves. And we also have this instinct to help the person. So the moral law is what arbitrates or judges between the two instincts and enables us to decide to follow one or the other route. And there may be times we would choose to jump in, at times we would not, because we know certain other preconditions that would affect the outcome. And so we don't, or maybe we're just afraid and we don't jump in to help. Well, we have this instinct of self-preservation and this instinct to come to the aid of another human being. Imagine Corrie ten Boom's family, okay? I think of them in World War II when I think of these two competing instincts. Surely they had the natural instinct to protect themselves. I mean, Corrie watches her precious sister die in the concentration camp, but they also had this instinct to help the persecuted, hurting, terrified Jewish people who were being mistreated. So the moral law wasn't one of those instincts. The moral law was the objective moral value that presided over those two instincts, self-preservation and the instinct to help another, the altruistic instinct that would actually negate their own survival at their own risk. So it enables me at times to act against my own natural instinct of self-interest and self-preservation and risk my own safety or the safety even of someone else for the sake of something else. Think of soldiers in battle. Yeah. They risk their own safety for the sake of the American people and their families at home. So it can't be merely an instinct. So we've already shown that it can't be just an evolutionary survival instinct. And it's not an instinct in the sense of it's just this natural urge that helps the species to carry on. It's more than that because it judges between instincts and causes us to choose one over the other and sometimes against our own self-interest and self-survival.
Yeah. No, you make such a wonderful point. Yeah, that's why we have the Medal of Honor is to celebrate those who went against perhaps that natural instinct towards self-preservation and risk their own life to save another. Again, it's that modeling of that Christ-like sacrifice that we celebrate and that all cultures celebrate across time. It's universal.
Well, and you know, I have to say here before we go on, we thank you for your service because you were one of those people that stepped forward and you said, I don't know where I'm going to end up being stationed, but I'm going to make this sacrifice because there's a bigger objective here. It's more than just about me. And you do it at your own self-risk for the sake of righteousness, not only surviving, but flourishing in not only our nation, but the entire world. And so people like you who step up and say, yeah, I'm willing to risk it. We call out the noble character trait within them in doing so, and rightly so, because this moral law, this altruism doesn't just make us survive. It makes us willing to risk our own safety for the safety of others and not just our family. Sometimes people who disagree with us, even here in America, because it's right and because we want righteousness to prevail. So thanks.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's, thank you for that. And, you know, as we're looking through, you know, this falling flat ultimately of morality just being in a subjective preference, like something that I like, or, you know, trying to anchor it in Darwinian evolution, which again, it cannot come about. We also have to kind of dismantle this idea too, that it's this relativism that tries to creep in there and especially advocate for this thing called tolerance. So one thing that I so appreciated with Frank Turek's research is that he exposed that this concept of tolerance that we hear, you know, preached ad nauseum, depending on what news station you're on, especially, it actually implicitly affirms the existence of an objective moral standard, because what it's saying is that which being tolerated is in fact, surprise, a bad thing. So tolerance operates on this idea that there is right, there was wrong, and we have to bear up with that which is ultimately false. Now, why is this stipulation here? Is because you don't have to tolerate goodness. And we actually see this in Galatians 5, 20 through 23. It says, but the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, forbearance, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Against things, there is no such law. But when people are forced into embracing and being tolerant, it's because they're having to withstand something that ultimately is morally false. And so even with kids, you know, when you hear, especially depending on where your teens are being taught or what they've heard, they might say, oh, you just need to be tolerant. If that claim comes up, you can ultimately use that for a conversation that points to the existence of an objective moral standard. And what's neat though is
I have said that sometimes in a course that I taught was that you don't have to tolerate that which with which you agree.
Yeah, that's true.
That you think is right and good. What you have to tolerate are those things you find burdensome, wrong, or in error. And that's the only reason you tolerate it to begin with. Otherwise, you're gung-ho in agreement with it.
Yeah. Very true. And, you know, people will automatically default to the existence of objective moral standards when they are wronged in some way. I mean, it even if it's something minor, like being cut off in traffic, or gosh, have you ever waited in line at the grocery store and it's like a super long line and somebody cuts in front of you? It is like injustice. You know, we all get flustered. So nobody denies the existence of an objective moral standard when they are cut off in that shopping line. And, you know, it's awesome because it's like a silly example that expands upon, you know, we appeal to C.S. Lewis. It's amazing. Perhaps one of the best quotes I've ever heard is that, you know, if ever you're an individual and you think of something profound, like you've sort of come to some conclusion, you're like, oh my gosh, I made this profound observation in the world. What this gentleman said, he goes, a clock starts from that moment, from the time you said the profound thing to the time you realize that C.S. Lewis already said it, and he said it better. And so it's so true. Like, so we're going to appeal a little bit to, again, C.S. Lewis. He's phenomenal here, especially with regards to this idea of justice, because C.S. Lewis for a time was a very staunch atheist, and he was especially outraged at God for the existence of evil, which we're going to get to in a second in another podcast. But what he says here is, he goes, my argument against God was that the universe seemed so cruel and so unjust. And man, let me just pause real quick. Like, everybody has this innate sense of what is wrong. Like, even my toddler, God bless her, love that little girl. She has no problem taking your snacks, but the second you try to swipe one of her Cheez-Its, man, that little girl is just sensing all the injustice. Like, we all have this. So he goes, you know, my argument against God was that the universe seems so cruel and unjust. Everybody, even from the smallest baby, can recognize this. But how had I got this idea of just and unjust? A man does not call a line crooked unless he has some idea of a straight line. What was I comparing the universe with when I called it unjust? And that was kind of this profound moment in Lewis's life where he realized that, man, I've got nothing to complain outrage against if God does not exist. But the only way that I can claim outrage against things that were unjust is the fact that God actually does exist. And if there's injustice, then there's ultimately good.
Yes. Now, we love C.S. Lewis. That doesn't mean, by the way, let me just make this comment, that we agree with them on all theological
things. Not all things.
Okay?
Yeah.
Right. There are some things we disagree with, and that makes no less of his profound statements that are true. And that's why we have our intellect to make that judgment. And as you said, he came out of atheism, but we appreciate so much of what he was able to recognize about reality. That is true. And he recognized that to say anything at all was unjust requires a standard of justice to exist prior to that, for us even to know that something is unjust or call it unjust. We're automatically, mentally, intellectually comparing it to this standard that's already out there that presides not only over others' actions, we can see it more clearly when others wrong us, but we notice by our own guilt and shame and our excuse making that it presides over our actions as well. So to say anything is unfair or wrong or evil requires that there is a supreme standard of fair and right and good that already exists against we are measuring to know this. Now, let's just review for a second. In our first premise, we've argued that if a moral law exists, that it must come from a moral being. It can't come from an impersonal force. It can't come from nature as natural law. Natural law only describes what is. It's a descriptive statement about what is and what patterns we see. But moral law describes what should be. And there is no concept of ought or should, except in personal or originating in personal moral beings. But though we as humans are moral beings, it can't have come from within us. And we know this because we frequently fail to keep the moral law, though we are aware of its standard. Our excuse making, our rationalization of our behavior shows that we recognize this moral law. Now, the second premise says we provide, in the second premise, rather, we provided evidence that there is an objective moral law. We argued against the notion that moral law is subjective and emotionally based. We're not creating emotions, but it's not only emotions, because while we often do feel strong emotions when the moral law is violated, we know through our intellects when the moral law is violated, not just through our emotions. We even rationalize our own behaviors when we break it. We also show that while the expression of the moral law varies from culture to culture, there are undergirding values that are universal. For instance, that it is wrong to murder, that it is wrong to rape, that it is wrong to abandon your comrades in battle. These are universally understood as evil and wrong. Nor is the moral law merely evolutionary instinct because that aids in survival, since we have competing instincts and the moral law must judge between the two to help us determine which instinct to follow. And finally, the fact that we teach the moral law, just as an aside, we need to be aware that just because we teach it doesn't mean it's just culturally based. I mean, think about math. We teach 2 + 4. That didn't come to be true when we taught it to our kids. It was true before we taught it to our kids. So this brings us then to a conclusion. We argue then, based on the fact that if there is a moral law, it requires a moral lawgiver, and there is moral law, therefore, there is a moral lawgiver, and this moral lawgiver is external to humans.
Yeah, amen. And you know, as we are, and of course, we're creeping our way closer. We're setting this systematic classical approach to arguing for the Christian understanding of God. So we're getting steps closer. But you know, Tricia, as we are winding down on time here, there's often a challenge that is leveled that comes in the form of a bit of a brain teaser with regards to this concept of morality or objective good. And this brain teaser is commonly known as the Euthyphro dilemma. Now, this is a bit fun. Do you or can you articulate for us what the Euthyphro dilemma states?
Yeah, the question is raised by Euthyphro many, many years ago. Is something good because God deems it good? So he just arbitrarily decides what's good, and maybe killing people is good, and God just decides what's good and labels it as that, therefore that makes it good. And that makes God capricious. Not truly good in his nature, and so we shouldn't worship him. Or God could have said that being a coward was good and sacrificing yourself for another is morally evil. So what kind of God is that? I mean, is that somebody we want, is that somebody we would want to worship? Or is it a good unto itself? But if there is no good apart from God, it's good in itself, and God has to recognize it. That means God has to submit, and he also... is under this standard, and it determines it's what makes him morally good is meeting the standard.
Well, thankfully, there is a third answer, as we know that good exists, is not external to God, but God himself is morally good, so that when he declares something is good, he is doing so because he himself is good, and that goodness flows from his very nature. And we actually see that in Psalms 34:8. Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man who takes refuge in him. So there, again, Euthyphro dilemma, often very fun. You'll see it on TikTok a lot, but it is just easily refuted very quickly for kids there. If they happen to see it, it's not something to be intimidated about.
No, it now, very nature, because God is goodness.
And, he is and goodness.
When we say God is morally good, we don't mean he's morally good in the same way humans are. We must meet the standard of perfection. But this moral law isn't over God, so that he must meet standard, and he's only good because he does. He is morally good and is the source of good because he is goodness. And so we call him morally good in a slightly different way than we mean it for humans. He's the one that sets the standard because it flows from his nature. Okay, now, Amy, well, let's close us out by talking about our kids. Just we've already talked about them a little bit. Let's talk about them a little more, how we're going to get this in our kids' minds and hearts.
So there's a couple fun ways that you can do this. So for our little kids, you can play a very easy game, and that's just who's the bad guy, spot the bad guy. So this is fun because what you're going to do is you're going to pop the popcorn and you're going to pick a fun movie, especially one that has a clear villain. Or maybe if your kids are you know, clever, they haven't seen one, pick like a not so clear villain. So great options are like the movie Tangled, Lion King, Toy Story 2. And then what you want to do is to ask your kids, okay, who's the good guy and who is the bad guy? How can they tell? Is it just their opinion of how they like or dislike the actions that determines whether this person or this character is bad or good? You know, do feelings actually make something good or bad? And then you want to really kind of distinguish, okay, if this person is a good is the good guy, do they always do good things or do they sometimes do bad things? And so what you're doing is you're helping kids recognize that we can distinguish between a villain and a hero based on whether or not they violate objective moral standards, especially if they are exploiting, manipulating, abusing another individual, which you'll see in Mother Gothel in Tangled. And then we can recognize when someone is acting in a good way, when they actually, their actions match and affirm the, likewise, the dignity of others, the flourishing of society, those sorts of things. Now, that doesn't mean that that person is 100% intrinsically perfectly good. No, we are all fallen and broken in some way. And that's why it's important for kids to recognize, because children by nature think in very concrete black and white, good versus bad. And what's helpful for kids especially is to recognize that when it comes to fallen human beings, that we can do good things, we also do very much bad things. And that's why we are in desperate need of a savior. And that can only be through Christ Jesus, who came, who lived a perfectly sinless life, who died and rose again for us. Now, that's fun for kids. Your teenagers might start giving you eye rolls, though, if you're, you know, because I don't know, do it on a Thursday and do like a throwback movie night. Like, guys, we're going to watch Cars. My kids would be all on board for that. But for teens, sometimes having a discussion, which I know, Trisha, you've had discussions with your high schoolers as well. Sometimes just having a fun, spirited debate is really helpful. Mm-hmm. So you can ask your kids, you know, does each person have their own truth? So I got to teach in a high school apologetics class. They were 12th grade. And that was one of the things these high schoolers believed, is that, you know, I can have my truth and she can have her truth and he can have his truth. And we're all just supposed to coexist, you know, as the bumper sticker says. And so there were two guys in the class that I noticed beforehand were like wrestling and goofing off. Like, these two were buddies. And so I picked these kids out and I'm like, okay. So I looked at the first kid and I was like, okay, let's say, you know, it is your truth that, you know, people should respect other people's boundaries and that, you know, we should all live in a sort of harmony with one another, to where we are seeking out, you know, each other's betterment. So we're building each other up. And the one kid was all on board for that, right? So then I looked at his buddy and I was like, but let's say your friend has a different idea of truth, where it's his truth that he is totally justified in punching anyone in the face that he wants to for any reason at any time. That's his truth. Now, can those two belief systems coexist? And very clearly, they'll say no. Of course, the one kid was like all on board. He was like, yeah, let me live my truth, you know, to his poor friend. So it's kind of a silly example, but those are little conversations that you can have to be like, okay, you know, what happens when two opposing truths conflict? How do you determine who is right? You know, can wrongness be based in a demographic or a descriptor? Meaning, are women always oppressed? Is male leadership always wrong? Why or why not? And so asking these good probing questions help kids think around the issue rather than just parroting what they've heard on a TikTok video. So again, have good conversations with your teens, because teens, you know, they usually are game for a spirited debate. And so if you can nurture that within your home, whether it's, you know, on a drive or at the dinner table, that can be a really easy way to help getting your kids think about the existence of objective moral values. Now, Trisha, do you have any ideas, like in your experience, have you found something that really helps kids wrestle with his concept of objective morality?
I was just thinking about a little bit, maybe older kids, you can modify it for younger ones when they sin or fail. I don't mean just make a mistake, but actually a rebellion or disobedience, whether it's our kids or our grandkids or our kin kids, and helping them to understand where that sense of guilt comes from, and sharing with them Romans 2:15, because the moral law is written on our hearts. Now, in most things, we have a sense of guilt about initially because we are aware that we have failed to reach that moral standard. We've missed the mark, which is what Romans chapter 3 talks about. Just bringing it back to that once we're calmer and the discipline is over, to help them get a context for what it means to violate God's moral law. And that ultimately, it's not even wronging your parents or letting yourself down. This is against God's holiness, who is our cause, our creator, our sustainer, and our savior. And so that's what we need to be thinking through so that we make that transfer from disciplining to them understanding failing to meet the standard and why Christ needed to come for forgiveness. So this is a great opportunity for that.
I love that. All right, mamas, we are so grateful that you joined us for this wonderful discussion on the existence of morality, objective moral values, and this look at the moral argument for God. If you would like more information on Mama Bear Apologetics, just head on over to mamabearapologetics.com. That's mamabearapologetics.com. We have got all sorts of things for you. We've got podcasts, we've got blogs, we've got an amazing resource list that I believe we have broken down even into subject. So that if there's a question your kids hit you with or something you're wrestling with yourself, man, just hop over to the resource page. You can find a book, an article, whatever it may be to really help nurture your own study. And then if you have a parenting conference, a ladies event, a retreat that's going on within your church, or you as a church just want to help pour into your congregations to help them raise children who stand firm in the faith, there's an opportunity for you to request a Mama Bear speaker to come to your church event. Let me tell you, these things are such a blessed time of fellowship because not only do we get to pour into your congregation, then your congregation gets to bring forward the questions or the situations that they are personally dealing with. And we are able to equip them with practical tips, techniques, knowledge, and wisdom to help them in that present situation and to help them be faithful in the future as well. So if you would like a Mama Bear speaker to come to your event, head over to Mama Bear Apologetics and you can request right there. And also, I want to toss this in. If there is something going on in your family or maybe a question that you've had, one of the things we love to do is specifically write blogs or do podcasts to help you understand that situation. So if there's something going on in your life or maybe a question that your kid has hit you with, man, hop on over, send us a request, say, hey, I would love it if you guys addressed this issue. And man, we would be happy to be able to do a podcast, a blog, whatever we feel God leading us to do to help equip you in your present state. So, mamas, thank you so much for joining us today, and we will see you next time at Mama Bear Apologetics. If you've enjoyed this podcast, hop over to mamabearapologetics.com where you can get more links to podcasts, blogs, and even request a speaker for your next women's event, family retreat, or your next church conference.
Mama Bear Apologetics is a listener-supported program, so if you really like what we're doing, please go over to our website, www.mamabearapologetics.com, and click donate.